Gadzooks, Cat. What are you up to? This is Samwise. He's our cat. He's our male cat. He's tabby, orange and white, smart, like, he'll open doors, curious, and he's a sweetheart because he, like, he'll catch chipmunks, but he won't harm them. He'll let them go and he wants to chase them again. Anyway, why am I introducing a cat? My name is Jan Gelkowski, and this is an inaugural podcast for me. And I have blogged for a while, but I gotten into this podcast stuff because of the impetus of my younger son, mostly, where I was listening to the 538 podcast, and I thought this was a new medium to check out, so here I am, don't know how it will go. I'll tell you who I am in a little bit, but let's talk about first what the podcast I'm on is. To sort of be about and this kind of thing. So I've done a lot of communicating and done a lot of studying about geophysics, climate, nature, that sort of stuff. And I'm very interested in biology stuff, although not professionally. And very interested in the interface and interaction between biology and people. And as underscored by the impact of climate, biggest thing around. And I thought it might be good to just sort of, instead of having a very structured kind of presentation that I'm used to, just kind of like ad-lib and put out there just random thoughts about things, about nature. And the suspicion that I have that there's a lot about nature that we can learn and a lot about these big questions that we can learn in the very small. So it's 10th November, 2018, and I'm standing on our deck in Westwood, Massachusetts, where I live with my wonderful wife, Claire. There's just been a reasonably strong storm. Don't know if it was technically an nor'easter or not, 2 inches of rain that came through. Big wind, gale wind, but, you know, it's pretty big. And a lot of the leaves are down. And we got some oaks on the edge of our property, and there are leaves everywhere. And you can probably hear the wind rustling in the background. Hopefully it won't dominate the sound, but I doubt it. And we're at a change of season here, being November and transitioning to cold, and there are things that you see around the yard that are different. The trees are non-conifers, shedding a lot of their leaves. They're bare. Samwise, our tabby here, is somewhat apprehensive about all these leaves. It's a new thing. He does this every year. Kind of has some memory of it, but not entirely. He's wondering if it's cars that are on the ground. And so he's a little skeptical of this expedition. But he seems to be getting over it, and now he's on the ground. And looking around. So in case you're wondering, we don't let our cats out. We have 3 of them, actually. And 2 of them are behave well enough so that we can actually take them out, and they have a harness on and stuff, and we put a leash on them. And that's the extent to which we'll get out. A little bit in towards the winter, I will actually go out with Sam in the yard without, I mean, I'll keep the leash with me, but I'll have it unattached because unlike his sister, his twin sister, he will actually listen. And if I tell him to stop or come, he will do that. And so that's why I'm comfortable doing that. Darla, no. Darla has a bit of a mind of her own. She's skittish, much more instinctive. And she'll go out on a leash and she loves it. But like right now, I offered to her to get ready to go out. She will have nothing to do with the harness today, so she's not going anywhere. We do this because, well, we love these guys and girls. We have actually 2 females, one male, the third one is Dusty. And Dusty deserves a story unto itself, perhaps in another podcast. But anyway, it's not good for the world around us for them to be out, and so forth. In addition, I've gotten, when Sam has been out sometimes, a little bit freer than I should have let him. I have attracted poison ivy. We do have a lot of that stuff around here. Why we do is another subject for another podcast. I think probably the biggest reason, the biggest personal reason is we used to have two cats that were outdoor cats, Rumble and Choke. And, we have strong circumstantial evidence that Toby got eaten by a coyote, which we also have around here. Lest you think I think the coyotes are evil animals and that sort of stuff. They're actually quite beautiful. We saw one this year, you know, at the edge of our backyard who was just checking out the place. And, they're very lean and marvelous hunters. And they've been relegated to the margins of our area, because of expansion of people and development. But they're kind of coming back and learning how to coexist. Although coexistence occasionally means eating a cat. Or a small dog, for that matter. So I'm particularly at peak time when the coyotes are having pups. I'm very wary because coyotes can be ambush hunters, and I don't want one of our cats to snatch. Sam is now trying to go into the woods, and I'm not confident enough that we've gotten rid of all the poison ivy leaves here yet, so I'm not going to allow him to do that. Yeah, we'll wait another month or so. We'll go. I'll let you go free. And then you can check things out. But anyway, so we live in a nice lot in a relatively, for the neighborhood, a relatively small house. It's a split level here. We have two very large houses to either side of it. And on a fair amount of property, where for example, an older property, we're not on tap sewer, for example. And Claire does a wonderful job at maintaining the landscaping and making sure that the yard is beautiful. And we've, over the years in discussions, but she does all the work. I just talk about it and I'll occasionally do things like rototill. But she does all the work. She's out there all the time. We've occasionally started to move our plantings to be more native New England plants rather than the canonical ornamental, even in our choice of trees and stuff. And that's why that's a good idea. Yet another subject. Lots of potential podcasts here, to talk about. But today, the thing is the yard, the introduction, and the leaves, the oak leaves that are everywhere. It's interesting. I've sometimes done this, but it's interesting if you go down and you go look under the oak leaves. There's a whole world there. There are things trapped under the oak leaves where it retains moisture and even some warmth. And there's fermentation going on now that you have nature, beginning to breathe out after its growth period during the summer, meaning the carbon dioxide it captured during the year more or less gets all transferred back into the atmosphere during the winter. And, so the soil is breathing out that stuff, and it's also breathing out because there's respiration involved. It's all causing heat. And the leaves will capture that heat, and there things can survive there longer than you think they would, given the temperatures and even snow that will come later. And another podcast that I definitely have planned to go down in our yard sometime with a large magnifying glass to look at the things that I see and just describe them. And this will be a little informed. I'll do a little bit of homework before I do this. So I'll let you know in the descriptions what I see. But there's a whole ecosystem down at the level of ferns on the ground level, principally dominated by some remarkable creatures called rotifers. And it's interesting because there are these little ecosystems on the small side of things, and because of where they are, they're, you know, apart from overall climate conditions, stuff like that. But they're pretty disconnected from everything. They really don't kind of like, aren't affected much by things going on. I suppose if you spray pesticides on your lawn, they're going to be affected. But by and large, what's happening in the wider world, they're out of that scale, and that doesn't really bother them so much. Again, you know, exception, there's an extended drought, I suppose, the moisture, although the rotifers are really tough, and you can capture water at a fine thing, which is why bryophytes, really stand desiccation very well, because they capture water and hold it for a long period of time. So these ecosystems tend to stand up to major changes that are occurring all around us. And that's a fascinating subject, because it indicates how things are connected and are connected to what's going on in the wider world. Sam's now on his hunt looking for chipmunks or things that he could possibly chase. Okay, so back here, I had to take a little break because Sam was spooked by having a wind gust, and he didn't like that. It came up pretty fast. So he hightailed it around the corner, dragging the leash after them, and went into the house. Twice then. Cats have learned to coexist with people in a sort of symbiotic relationship. During the service, catching rodents around things, and now just being cute and dominating the internet. Anyway, I was talking about rotifers, I think. Anyway, so there's a lot that goes on in the small, and the rules of living in the small are much different than in the large. For many creatures at the size scale of rotifers, smaller, for example, a water droplet is something you desperately want to avoid, because at that scale, there's this property relating water and surface tension, which is devastating. I mean, if you have a droplet, if an ant encounters a droplet of water, getting detached from a droplet of water because of the surface tension is very difficult. This encounter can be fatal. So the point of that is not that that is so remarkable that they can survive that. The point of that is that the rules of living at that scale are different. And I think it's useful to understand that, because you realize when you look at that stuff that we're actually pretty large animals compared to the rest of things in nature. We're pretty big, and that colors our view of things. Animals at that scale don't see the world the same way that we do, and we don't see it the same way that they do. Nor are we, and it's not just that we are no longer into nature as much as we used to be when we had to hunt and subsist, and we're at the mercy of growing food, things like that, but it's also that we just don't feel certain things in the same way that other creatures do. I mean, let's take another one, just look at the time. Okay, so I'm now at the back of our yard, bordered on a wetland, which is called Rock Meadowbrook, Westwood. And it's periodic, it's episodic. People will define how wide this thing is depending on the convenience of stuff. So when people want to build things, trying to dodge the Wetlands for Protection Act, they'll define the boundary of the wetland way at the other side of the brook. Even though I'm standing probably 30 feet away from a standing pond of water, and it's not from rain, it's actually from the brook itself. So this is a wetland, and as a consequence, because it's largely pretty well protected, knuckle pretty well protected, we get an awful lot of migrating birds We have a year-round population of birds, but there is definitely a dramatic change in complexion here. The noisiest and the most dramatic ones are, of course, the Canada geese that summer here and don't know where they come from, presumably someplace south or west. And they will raise their families, actually, in the marshy area of the brook. And we have, at times, had a couple of adult geese with a whole bunch of goslings at various sizes, sometimes really little ones, sometimes much larger ones, coming in through our backyard, grazing on our grass. In fact, this convinced Claire and I to allow the back portion of our yard to just grow free. We don't mow that anymore. And that's largely because, you know, it's not only just pesticides down in the ground, but if you basically mow your lawn, you are basically affecting the ecosystem. Now there's a food source that would normally be there that isn't. And living close like that and being aware of these creatures that come in and out of our lives is really an education. Every season, learn new things about them. The other thing is, well, what I was talking about science. So, migrating birds are on a clock. They're just always on a clock. They're on a clock to arrive and get nesting areas. And so it is advantageous for them to show up early. It's also risky for them to show up early because oftentimes when they show up, their nesting areas are not in a season where their food is plentiful. This is the most dramatic in the case of migrating robins. They often show up and they're predominantly, although not exclusively, carnivores. And that's something I only learned this year. May show up in March in the snow and not have anything to eat. We have found dead robins who basically, after the migration and the consumption of calories that entailed, ended up not making it into the nesting. But the advantage is if you have a nesting area, you can potentially raise your brood, have access to food, that's pretty good. So they are really on the clock, and time is compressed for them because there are things that they need to get done. And in the end, they have to move, and that's their thing. That's part of their survival pattern. So you'll begin to see, even at the height of summer, you'll begin to see the adult Canadian geese launch off from the marsh and not go very far, but just take a turn around in the area and then they'll come right back. They're basically, after being on the ground for a while, they're basically stretching them up and getting used to the whole idea of flocking. And presumably there are young adults that will be joining them for their first migration. Long distance migration, that pattern has season progressed. And they need to know what this migration thing is like and what they're going to do. So that's out of time. They move and they do their winter thing and come back. And in time for the next year. But we don't march, and we have holidays. Maybe that's why holidays are so important to us. They give sort of time step of how things are progressing. Maybe that's why birthdays are so important. I don't know. But I think it's important to note that every time you come around, how things have changed. And again, at the Rock Meadow Brook, one of the notable things, something that you'll see in many, many New England forested areas, and along the coast, is this used to be a forested marsh. There are trees all through it, all the way down the end of it and across to the other side. Trees so dense you could barely see the houses on the other side. It was sort of few built on the other side. And without exception, these trees are now dead. And so it raises the question, why? Why are these trees were not dead at some point. They were all about, doing pretty well. The other thing about them is that they're only of a certain size, approximately of a certain size. And, that
you know, might suggest there's some episodic in some way. And it could be. I mean, it could be, but not, in this case, not. Because if you actually venture into the marsh, you'll find very large trees that are also dead, except that they've fallen over. And so you don't see them anywhere. So there's a real question as to why this is happening. The basic message here and everywhere else here is that the water table is up. And we can talk about why that is over time. So this is about introducing the podcast, introducing living at the interface in an area where I'm going to just taking some time to just stop and share some of the views and experiences around here and insights about things, including the small and the very large. And so with that, I'm going to bring this to a close, get this into the editing, and hope that once I get it out there, maybe I'll get some kind of an audience. Don't know. Thanks for listening.